Hello, I'm Tom Clark, bringing you a special edition of Politics Weekly. Jack Straw has confirmed that he plans to publish detailed draft legislation to overhaul the House of Lords in the autumn. Speaking at a special seminar arranged by The Guardian and Unlock Democracy, he explained he wanted to see at least 80% of the chamber elected. But he faced tough questions from an expert audience about why the plans have taken so long to devise, and indeed about whether they'll really happen at all, given that the Labour government seems to have entered its dying months. Jonathan Friedland was chairing the event, so let's hand over to him.
Welcome to The Guardian's wonderful new building. My name is Jonathan Friedland. I work here, and this welcome to this event, co-sponsored by The Guardian and our friends at Unlock Democracy. As you know, our guest of honour is the Secretary of State for Justice, Jack Straw, but we will be responding. The format will be a conversation between him and me for 30 minutes or so, perhaps less, and then we will go over to our Strictly Come Dancing-style celebrity panel I'm not going to say who's who, for you to, for some responses, and then we're going to open it up into a larger conversation. And the Secretary of State has very graciously agreed that it really be a conversation back and forth, and that will be very good. The subject before us, as you know, is moving towards an elected second chamber, and I'm very keen that we keep it focused on that. There's obviously many, many other questions we might want to ask Jack Straw on this day, but we're going to try and keep discipline. There may be one or two that slip in, even perhaps from me. But otherwise, I really think we should try and keep it as focused as we can. Let's get plunged right in then, if you're happy to do that.
Sure, of course.
How will we explain, do you think, to future generations that a Labour government that will have been in for at least 12, perhaps 13 years, maybe more, but 12 or 13 years, arrived with an unelected second chamber, and here we are 12 years on, and there's still an unelected second chamber. How do we explain that?
How you explain it is that it's very hard to reform the House of Lords, is the answer. But we've made much more progress than I think people anticipated. And the truth is, there wasn't a consensus a dozen years ago about what to do. And a lot of argument inside the Labour Party, as well as with the other parties, about whether you had an elected second chamber. Great anxiety within the Labour Party, given the history of the House of Lords, that it would simply be used as a battering ram against an elected Labour government if it also became elected. And so what happened was that this Royal Commission was established, which to try and get a consensus, which... And actually, some of the ideas which are now in the white paper, which I published last year, have been drawn from that. But they came to a kind of stalemate. What we did
is the Wakeham Commission.
It's the Wakeham Commission, yeah. But what we did do in 1999, which has had a very big effect on the significance of the Second Chamber, was to remove all but, as it turned out, 92 of the hereditaries and to establish a rule that no one party had a majority. And what that has done has been to make the House of Lords much, much more assertive as a second chamber. And you can see that in all sorts of ways. See it in terms of the attendance in the chamber or in the House of Lords, which is much more significant than it was. In a number of defeats of parts of government legislation which they've affected. And interestingly, I think, and Meg will have the figures, I think, but getting on for half the amendments which have been made by the House of Lords against government advice have subsequently been accepted by the government in the final stages of the legislation. So it's become a more assertive... I don't mind this, by the way. I think it's become a much more assertive chamber. That said, I personally thought when I was given this job, when I was moved from the Foreign Office in 2006, that we had to come to a decision in the House of Commons about whether or not the House of Commons was going to move and come to a decision in favour of an elected chamber. And colleagues here will recall that late and great Robin Cook tried to do that in February 2003. But the result, for all sorts of reasons, and my particular role in that was not the one I'm terribly proud of. But for all sorts, just to get that out of the way.
Why are you not proud of it?
Because I did not vote at the time for an elected second chamber, all right? So I've changed my mind, so just get that one.
Well, let's not rush it out. let's not rush it out.
So anyway, just to deal with sure. that, the result was that no decision at all was made. I mean, the House voted against every single alternative, which was kind of absurd, and that led to further stalemate. Now, happily, when I took on this job, I got together this all-party group. We put a series of proposals to the House, and we managed to get the House to make a decision. And we voted in favour of 80% and 100%, and against all other alternatives. And there's been all-party consensus for that, and that's provided the platform for the change. Now, you ask me why.
Your own personal journey. I mean, well, you've gone from being an opponent of an elected House. You voted, as you said, for an appointed chamber, and now you're in a different place. Just talk us through your own move.
It wasn't an issue about which I felt particularly strongly. This is kind of a lame excuse for those who want to write this, but this was in February 2003, of other things, and I remember I got off the plane, went upstairs to vote, and somebody said, "Go and vote in that lobby." And I said, "What is it about?" I said, "Okay, fine." And then, so that was that. But when that's not a good reason, but it is the reason. But subsequently, when I actually sat down and thought about this in much, much more detail, I came to the conclusion, which others had shared, which was that we had to move to an elected second chamber, and that the case for this was inescapable. And I'm entitled to change my mind, and I've been frank about my own particular journey.
Yeah, no, the only bit of that people will find it very hard to believe, I think. I mean, not that you were distracted because there was about to be a war, which people understand that, but the notion that, you know, you were just told to go into the lobby and you hadn't thought about it. I mean,
well,
is it the case that actually you were a conviction believer in an appointed second chamber because you believed an elected one would challenge the primacy?
Wasn't much of a conviction, was the truth, but it wasn't. I mean, it was a second order issue for me, and it then became a first order issue as I looked at it in great deal more detail.
I mean, just before we leave the subject of my first question, in a way behind it was the worry, and some people do voice this, that it is in some ways an indictment of a Labour government, that there was a Royal Commission 10 years ago, and that all these years have passed by, and apart from this reduction in the hereditaries down to 92, and we know there's plans afoot to reduce that further, that the body remains more or less as it was. I mean, in other words, it's not just a sort of process question, it is a black mark against this Labour government that it failed to tackle question.
I don't think it's a black mark. I mean, the truth is that if you look at all the constitutional change we have done, I mean, we have produced, in Vernon Bognador's phrase, a quiet revolution in terms of the constitution of this country. And it is, I mean, actually, it's more than a quiet revolution. It's been dramatic. Mm. If you think about where Unlocked Democracy was and what they were saying 20 years ago, 15 years ago, and what we have done on the Human Rights Act, Freedom of Information, which was criticised at the time for being, quotes, no more than the previous Freedom of Information Code, but is actually one of the most radical Freedom of Information regimes in the world. One of the things it's done, by the by, is dramatically strengthened the power of journalists and backbenchers against government. I don't resent that at all. I mean, I think it's been overall a good thing, not a bad thing, as well as devolution to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. I mean, these are things which have totally changed the landscape. But what you have to do, if you're making constitutional change, you have to get a consensus, and you do. It doesn't mean you go to the lowest common denominator, but you've certainly got to get a consensus in your own party, and you've got to, where you're dealing with the fundamental structure of our legislature in a context where we don't have, and I think for good reasons, a basic law where the constitutional building blocks have to be approved by qualified special majorities or referendum. Where you have got to get a consensus, because I've often said that the constitution, I mean, it includes the electoral system, for example, cannot be just a tool partisan tool in the hands of the government of the day. So that's why we've worked very hard. And the difficulty, Jonathan, with the reform of the House of Lords is that people were always in favour of an said, let's have an elected House of Lords. And that was the easy bit. Then the question was, well, how do you achieve that? And crucially, how do you get to a situation where you have an elected second chamber, which is a complement to the first chamber and not a rival to it? Because if you get to a situation where it becomes a rival, then you end up with real paralysis in government, which you see in some other countries. And that's been the challenge. And I think we by very elaborate and careful process, we've now got to a point where we know how it would work. And that was in the white paper. And it's going to be in the further proposals we bring forward later this year.
I do want to drill into the detail of that, and we're going to do that in a moment, exactly what that blueprint would entail. Before we leave this, there's a point about consensus you said about across parties, but actually, in a way, implicit in what you've been saying is the problem wasn't between Labour and other parties. The problem has been within Labour. You have not been able to get a consensus
within
the parliamentary Labour
party. We have now. That's really been the crucial difference. We have now got a consensus, not only within the parliamentary party, but also within the party as a whole. And though, if you look at the numbers of Labour MPs who voted for an elected chamber, 80%, 100%, it's the majority of Labour MPs voted for that. And then our National Policy Forum last summer, in July 2008, voted very clearly for a wholly elected second chamber. So that's, you know, and that's, I say, one shouldn't criticise necessarily people inside the party. The reasons for, the reasons which I found convincing for quite a long time, in favour of having a second chamber or just putting up with an unelected second chamber, were not dishonourable. It was about the anxiety was that the law unelected lords would seek to undermine the will of an elected government. I mean that was the concern, and I say I think we managed to deal with that.
The assumption that most people are operating on is that time is running out, legislative time at the very least, on this government, and that we're looking in the last 9 months or so of this government's life. You can question that premise if you like, but I'm wondering whether we can look forward to, is this a problem that's going to be solved this side of an election? Will there be a bill before an election, a bill that's actually acted upon? We know there's obviously legislation being passed through Parliament now that deals with this hereditary question.
Yeah.
But more largely than that, what can we look for?
It's an incontrovertible truth that within the last 9 months of this Parliament, I'm not making any predictions about what happens thereafter, and I look at your opinion polls as I look at anybody else's, but just for the avoidance of doubt, I don't have to believe, and I certainly don't, that the election is a foregone conclusion, because I think that people face the choice. They'll come to a different view from that which appears to be the case from the opinion polls, and for very good reasons. But in terms of legislative time, allowing for the fact that Parliament resumes in early October, we've got about 6 months. I've never believed in the politics of pretense, so it would not be possible, I mean, even with consensus in both houses, to get through major legislation to establish a new second chamber in that time. What, however, I'm strongly of the opinion is possible is to put forward legislative proposals on which each of the parties has to make their position clear. And they've got to make their position clear, not only as a kind of tick in the box, but also as what priority they accord this. Certain that where the Labour government and the Labour Party lies, and also for the Liberal Democrats, where their position is. Going to be of interest is whether the Conservative Party follow through their 2005 manifesto commitment. They said, words to the effect that what they were going to seek was a consensus for, I think, a predominantly elected second chamber, was their phrase. Well, we've got that consensus. So now let us see them endorsing the specific proposals which we're putting forward, to which they have actively contributed in all-party talks over 3 years, or to the extent they don't, let them put forward alternatives.
Because that's the value, isn't it? The reformers say that at least get this consensus, in a way, nailed down, and then that will hold the next government of whichever party to it. You have talked about publishing legislation in the autumn. What does that mean?
Well, clauses, key sets of clauses, are currently being prepared on how the, these proposals in the white paper, which I published last summer, with some refinements, how to put the flesh on the bones. There's then an issue of exactly how that those clauses would be published. Would they be published as a draft bill? Would they be published as draft clauses? What kind of process would there be for the Commons to come to a decision? And we haven't made up our minds finally on that, but I'm personally very clear that what is needed now is for people to see the detail of how would this new architecture actually work? And if you like, not just the architecture, but the structural engineering to ensure it stays up. Or the naval architecture, I want to use another analogy to make sure it stays afloat, as well as it looks elegant. How would it work? What are the key elements? We've got to make a decision in government about the electoral system to be used. There are three mentioned as possibilities in the 2008 white paper, which were are first past the post, which is broadly favoured by most, but by no means all Conservatives. And I note that it's not favoured by George Young or Andrew Tyrie in the paper they published earlier in the summer. Or a regional list system, but with semi-open or open lists, or single transferable vote. And those are the choices. And I think the government's likely to come down, have made a final decision, in favour of the regional list system, but with open or semi-open lists, which is actually very different from the European election system.
Well, let's get now that we're into this level of detail, let's go right for it. And let's just, since you've promised us a free-flowing and open conversation, let's just, you tell us what your view is of all these different questions. I mean, let's start with this one on this electoral system, since you've raised it. I mean, all the other new elections that have come into play in UK life, partly because of that big constitutional change, that quiet revolution, almost all, I think, have been PR or some involved PR of some form, European elections, Scotland, etc., London and Wales. So where are you on that system? And when you say semi-open, how semi are we talking about?
Right. Where am I? I mean, it's no secret that one of the issues on which I have got, I've had strong convictions for some time. Have been in favour of first past the post for single member constituencies for the House of Commons. And the reason that I'm strongly in favour of that is because I believe that you need a system which provides clear majority governments. And whilst the objection to first past the post is that these days it's a minority that elects, ends up electing the government of the day, it is at least the largest minority by a long way. Whereas there are many objections to proportional representation, which I'm happy to debate, which typically ends up with often the smallest minority holding the power, as we've seen from Germany on many occasions and other countries, and quite often leads to governmental and parliamentary paralysis.
So that's for the House of Commons.
But that's the House of Commons. And I also very powerfully believe, even more powerfully than that, in having one member for one area of population. So there's this kind of direct personal relationship between the MP and his or her constituents. I mean, I feel that very powerfully indeed, and you lose that with proportionate systems. But the argument in favour of first past the post is that bluntly it does that, and it helps to deliver, generally speaking, strong government. Those arguments don't apply for an elected second chamber. So that's why I'm much more relaxed about the idea of having a proportionate system. And of the systems which are available, I think probably the most appropriate is the open or semi-open regional list system. You can have a single transferable vote system. And I you asked me how it would work. Well, it happens that in the back of this white paper, we gave, detailed examples of exactly how it worked, what the ballot paper would look like. And with an open list system, the parties and the candidates are down on the lists, and you go for the candidates that you want by marking them next to your preferred candidate. With the semi-open list system, you can either mark an X next to your preferred party or next to your preferred candidate. So that's how it works. It's a system which is used, I think, in part of the Belgium electoral system.
But as we all knew here, of course.
As you all know.
Yeah.
There's also details of the de Hondt formula for those who are interested in that.
As Again, familiar ground for everyone here.
Well, for those whose brains were burnt out on the detail of the European election system, as opposed to the Sanilac-EU system. Don't ask me to define the difference.
Okay,
but there is one.
Yeah, sure. And regions, quite large regions, are you?
They'd be. For the purpose of this exemplification, they'd be the same size, same regions. As for the European Parliamentary elections.
Okay.
I mean, you can change them, but I don't think there's any great sentiment for doing that. If you have single transferable vote, you then have slightly smaller constituencies, probably half, you'd have twice as many regions. And if you had first past the post, the most sensible way of doing it would be to have the old European electoral constituencies, which were typically about seven or eight Westminster constituencies.
Let's just try and rattle through these as quickly as we can. What about this proportion, whether it's wholly or partly elected? The House of Commons, as you told us, has voted for both 80% and 100%. Yeah. You've now a convert to election. So in your own mind, have you gone all the way? Do you have the zeal of a convert? Are you for 100% elected, or do you think there's still going to be a partial thing?
Well, what I think... I mean, I said in an interview I gave to Nick Watt, who's the front row here, which is in the Guardian this morning, that I think it's really important that reformers should not tie themselves in knots about whether it's 80 or 100% and make that a kind of... For this reason, I'm not saying don't regard that as important, but all the parties are agreed that the only way to get to an elected second chamber is by phasing it in so that you do it over three parliaments or three electoral cycles, but major parties have agreed that the electoral cycle would not be a fixed one, but be tied to each parliament, and I think that's sensible, each normal-length parliament. So you'd start, say, in Parliament 1, you elect, say, a third, or elect, say, 30%. Parliament 2, you elect 30%. Then there's an issue, do you go to 80% or do you go to 100%? Mm. In order to get to 100%, you've got to cross the 80% threshold. You haven't got to make a decision about that until that second parliament. And my view about this is because I just promise everybody here who's committed to this reform is getting this through the next stage is going to be hard. And what there will be is loads of people who've got argument after argument against the principle, but who don't rely on the principle, because actually once the thing is out, it's quite hard to argue. And all the parties are saying we're in favour of an elected second chamber. They'll argue on grounds of practicality, or they'll argue, well, you've currently got some genuinely good and great people in the Lords who are crossbenchers and some others. We would lose their benefit of their advice. Or they would argue about the bishops. And the other faith communities also are quite committed to having the bishops there. Now, my own view about this is that these arguments will work themselves out in the wash. If we get a decision to go to 80%, with a trigger in the legislation to go to 100%, and the trigger is then for the second parliament, then that would be an astonishing achievement. And the other thing I just say on this is this. Even if, say, you decided on 100%, if it wasn't working out, then it'd be open to the second or third parliament to change it back to 80% or something else. And I think it actually makes more sense, provides more reassurance, to say that you get to 80% and then there is a further final vote on whether you move 100%.
Although, very, very difficult to imagine any government saying people who are currently elected are now going to be appointed. I mean, to go back from 100%
to 80%. But at the point you're getting to 80%.
Yes, I understand. I just meant on the principle.
Of course. No. That, of course, is why, I mean, once this has happened, people say, how on earth did we have a second chamber which was unelected? Well, whose idea was that? But we've got to get there. And there are very, very strong, powerful vested interests.
You've raised these practical things. Let's go through some of those. I mean, the bishops and what place religious leaders would have in, if any, in some kind of elected chamber. How have you thought? I can see exactly how the delay helps defer this decision. But in principle, in your own mind, should bishops and clergy of any perhaps other faith be as of right in the second chamber?
If you have a wholly elected second chamber, obviously not. You can't have the clergy there as of right. But what I also just say to colleagues here is never underestimate the strength of feeling around not just the established church, but also from other faith communities, because other faith communities have regard, or some of them do, I mean, and the presence of the bishops as a voice for faith communities. Now, it is anomalous that in our current environment that the bishop should be present in the legislature. Yeah. There are historic reasons for that. I say that as somebody who's quite an active Anglican myself. So it's not. This is one of when I said I counsel against making, as it were, the best the enemy of the good. There is anxiety in our society about are we becoming a kind of faithless society? Mm. And I frankly don't think it's necessary for progress towards 80%, which is, I say, would be astonishing in itself, to be diverted or undermined by arguments about the bishops. We proposed anyway to reduce the number of bishops.
Yeah.
In practice, the number of bishops who turn up on any day is about four, because they have genuinely other jobs. that's how I would tend to handle
it. So what I'm hearing you saying is that you're imagining a second chamber which has 20% probably for the foreseeable future, which is not elected, and in that 20%, if you had your way, there would be some representation for those faith leaders.
You
want to see the back of them.
My own view is is that you don't see the back of them for, in your phrase, Jonathan, for 10 years, because you don't need to, and you wouldn't anyway, because they'd still be there, because they wouldn't. And you then make a decision about this.
Yeah.
And I think that, actually, my guess is that during that period, this is only a guess, the Church of England may well come to the view that it's appropriate for them not to be in the second chamber. But that's also part of this consensus. And I just add this too. It is not the case. If you have an established church, as we do, and actually quite a number of European countries continue to do, or until recently have had, it doesn't follow that if you have an established church, they have to have representatives in the parliament.
No.
It's a quite separate point.
Absolutely. Behind this question of appointment, and also it touched on it actually with the open and closed list, a lot of people who oppose a whole election argue that the objection is that under election there'll be party control. It will be party whips inside, but also just party managers outside deciding who gets on that list. And actually, even if it's semi-open and you can pick and choose, the names that get on that ballot paper will be chosen by party managers. How do you reassure people in this, as we move towards this elected future, that the second chamber will include the Martin Rees's, the Astronomer Royal, etc., the Baroness Warnock-type people, who would never be on a party ballot, open or closed?
Well, the only way you can guarantee that is by having a percentage who are appointed. And that's, I mean, if you look in the evidence, Meg's probably got the detail in her head, there are some second chambers which are mixed and have an element of almost always a minority of appointed people. So, you can do that. And if you have, say, a 20% appointed, then it means that you continue to have the Astronomer Royal, the former chiefs of the defence staff, distinguished medics and so on, who make a contribution, who might conceivably stand for election, but it's very unlikely. The second thing is that if you do that, then whatever system of election you have, it is much less likely, statistically, that any one party could ever gain control, even where you have a period, as, say, the Conservatives did between 1979 and 1997, where they were in power for four parliaments, or as currently we've had when we've been in power for three parliaments. And we give a lot of exemplifications about that in the back of last July's white paper. That said, Jonathan, it is a myth to suggest that at the moment the party whips don't operate in the Lords. They
do. Oh, no, I wasn't.
I mean, they do. Yeah. And I've, as it were, got scars on my back to prove that. The last point I'd make is that we're trying to establish an elected system where, for sure, people would stand, if they wanted to, under a party label, and the parties would put forward people, but where independents could stand. And I think they get elected. And having been elected, I mean, the proposal is, and there's agreement about this, is that you would serve for a single term of typically three parliaments, so it'd be between 12 and 15 years. And you wouldn't be allowed to serve for a subsequent term.
Only one term?
One term. So, you know, you do your 12 years or 15 years and then finish. And you would not be able to stand for the Commons for a sort of quarantine period, say for 5 years. So this would not be, for example, you know, a launch pad into Commons politics, as quite legitimately local government or the European Parliament.
On exactly those lines, but would you imagine a ban on members of the Second Chamber serving in the executive?
No, I wouldn't imagine that, because you're going to have to... I mean, if the Second Chamber is going to...
So it could actually still be a launch pad for a governmental ministerial career,
well,
just
sorry,
the same way?
No, hang on. Members could have a governmental ministerial career, but the chance of them having a high-level and sustained career in the Commons would be very limited.
Because as the First Secretary of State has proved, you don't have to be in the Commons to have a very high-powered ministerial career.
But
so if behind the idea of the ban on going to the Commons is we don't want too much politicking in the upper house, in the Second Chamber... Yeah. The fact that you can get a governmental career means you'll be just as biddable by the whips because you'll be looking out for promotion.
Well, hang on a second. No, look. Peter Mandelson is an exception, which then generally proves a rule, as it were, and always has been. But say we're constructing it carefully so that generally people would not see membership or couldn't see, indeed, membership of the Second Chamber as a launch pad for a career in the First Chamber. You might well get people who had retired from the First Chamber going into the Second Chamber. That's very different, just as you do at the moment. You have people going from the Commons into the Lords. And just on this issue of independence, although we do propose in the paper last July, the possibility, and I personally support it strongly, of recall ballots, which could be triggered after the first parliament had expired. Because you couldn't, I think you'd have to have some system, it would be intolerable to have somebody elected for between 12 and 15 years. And for some people say, thanks, I've got the money now, you know, I'm off. You have to have both attendance rules, but also some basic constraint on sort of abject bad behaviour. But within that, people would be very independent. You know, I think the whips in the new Second Chamber would have the same challenge as they do in the current Lords of corralling people into the voting lobbies on unpopular legislation.
I mean,
that's very difficult.
The only flaw, I suppose, in this single-term thing of somebody being in there for 15 years, it violates the Tony Benn rule, doesn't it? I mean, Tony Benn always says democracy means you have the power to throw people out if they make decisions that, you know, the people don't like. And that's always should be hanging over everybody who wields power.
Well,
in this situation, if somebody's once they're in for 15 years and never to face the electors again, in a way, all the arguments that people have made, and you're now a convert to them, for an elected Second Chamber, have been blunted, haven't they? Because the power of election has been effectively removed.
I've not discussed this particular detail with Tony, but it's an important point of detail and principle. But he was, I think you'll see, referring very much to the House of Commons, and that's a...
No, he makes the same argument about Europe and the European Commissioners. I mean, it's a principle, though.
A principle which I strongly subscribe to. But however, people got to make a choice about what kind of Second Chamber they want. If they want a Second Chamber which competes with the First Chamber, then, by all means, you have elections every Parliament. You could have it, you know, you could do... as in the US, you could have it every 6 years and so on. I mean, but with much more limited terms. Mm. My judgment is that you would lose more than you gain from that, because then you would have a second chamber which was replicating the first chamber, and it, although you could try and legislate so that it wasn't competing, it would end up competing, and people inevitably, because they were having to prove themselves to their electors, would start behaving in the way that members of Parliament and the Commons behave, in terms of, so you, and what you're then laying down, Jonathan, is I think a blueprint for paralysis between the two chambers, and that they would end up as rivals. Now, none of the political parties wants that, and I think for very good reasons. And I don't think the country would want it either. And it's, I may say, it's been, you know, arguments of that kind which in the past have, yes, tended to sway people, I mean, very strongly on the left, against, in their terms, bothering to go down the route of election for the second chamber. Mm.
The very last thing, and briefly you can, because then I want to bring in our panel and introduce them. When would the election for this chamber be? Same day as a general election? In off years, as there is in other jurisdictions?
What the view of the Labour Party and of the Conservative Party is that they should take place on the same day as a general election. I think I'm doing this from recollection. There may be people here who can speak for the Lib Dems. I think the Lib Dems' view is that they should take place on a fixed basis, say at the same time as the European parliamentary elections, or the same time as local government elections, on either a 4 or 5 year cycle. And there, the problem with what I'm proposing, of course, is that what if you have a 1964, 1974 situation, where you have in 64, you had a 64-66 election taking place within 18 months, and 74 taking place within the space of 8 months. And what we propose there is that there would not be elections for the second chamber if there was a general election for the Commons within, say, a 2 year period. Because And that's how you end up with a 12 to 15 year period.
What's your argument against the Lib Dem idea of having it on the European timetable?
The argument against that is that I think on quite a lot of the specific issues. I mean, I don't say that these are dying, that these are really quite difficult issues, and I've been on both sides of the argument as one tries to think it through. The argument against is that it could be very disruptive of government. Mm. The government is elected with a programme, and it is entitled to see it through. You could then, I mean, and governments of both persuasions become unpopular in their midterm, even if they get re-elected at the end of the term. I mean, it follows as night follows day that happens. And what you could then have is, say, an election, a midterm election, governments doing some unpopular things, the other party is saying, vote for our candidates in the second chamber elections, and we will stop the government's legislative programme. Now, you know, they'd be entitled to do that, but I'm quite sure it would happen. So that would then change, again, the character of the second chamber. But also, I think the British public might say, hang on a second, what we've legislated for here overall is for, to repeat my point, some paralysis. So it's better to have a clean system.
And by definition, it wouldn't be the whole chamber that's up for election.
No, it'd be a third.
It'd be a third.
Sure. But I mean, by the way, I mean, if you look at the numbers, that third could tip the balance.
Yes.
Particularly in the circumstances I've described.
The 80% circumstances. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very, very much for that. Let's bring in our panel. Time to introduce them. Three people who follow this debate extremely closely and expertly. On my immediate left here, Meg Russell, who quite literally wrote the book on House of Lords reform and follows it extremely closely from the Constitution Unit at University College London. Next to her, Peter Facey, our co-host today, who leads Unlock Democracy. And finally, my colleague, Polly Toynbee, who writes about a whole range of issues, as you know, but very much also on constitutional affairs. Polly Toynbee, why don't you kick off?
Okay. I think whenever it may be that Labour leaves office, it's kind of hard to know what we're going to regret most of the things it hasn't done. But I do think that constitutional reform is going to be very near the top of an awful lot of people's list. House of Lords reform has already been voted on. It isn't clear to me why there was this idea that you had to get consensus when it was always plain that the House of Lords, as currently constituted, sort of, were turkeys who were not going to vote for Christmas. So why didn't you just push it through? It could have been done. And the idea that it's now going to be 10 to 15 years before we get there, and if there's always a slight suspicion, as we know, that 56 Labour MPs have already put in a bid to be made peers, that and it's always very convenient.
Not me, Polly.
No, no. I'm sure not to you. Not yet, anyway. But there's always a great temptation for governments at election times to want to kick a lot of people upstairs and collect some safe seats for young, fresh blood. And so there is a slight suspicion, more than slight, that you've dragged your heels for reasons that, when it comes to it, although in favour, everybody's in favour in principle, in practice the present system serves prime ministers very well. You could, after all, do it right now. You could actually do it within the time you've got left if you said, right, we're just going to create 1,000 peers, or even just the threat of it. That's how the 1832 Reform Bill got pushed through. It's how the People's Budget got pushed through. Just say you'll do it. And it's not as if anybody could say that an elected Lords right now would be any kind of gerrymandering in Labour's favour, because it wouldn't. You've only got to look at the polls now, and you'd say this is, you know, this is honest stuff. We do it because we believe it, not because it's going to do us any favours as things stand at the moment. But, I mean, I realise that's wildly radical stuff, and the one thing you could do, though, is to have a referendum at the next general election and to say, we'll propose it. If you want, you can put in that 80 to 100. If you don't want to stick it in definitely as 80 or definitely 100, a referendum would be very easy to do. Why are you bringing this up now so late in the day? And I'm afraid it does, and you, in a sense, implied this too, smack of a certain kind of rather unsavoury political posturing. Let's stick it to the Tories and see if they can swallow this and put it in their manifesto and promise to follow it through. And if they don't, we find ourselves a good red line and a good bit of campaigning. And at this stage, having not done it for 11 and what will be 13, for 12 and what will be 13 years, it looks a bit thin. I think as an option, even as an option, to have a first-past-the-post system for the House of Lords would be catastrophic, would be even worse. It would lead to one-party rule, would be disastrous. The idea of the 20%, this is a rather technical point, which would be left perhaps for bishops and others, it is actually completely impossible within that 20% to balance in any way between gender, ethnicity and religion. If you start to look at the sums, Professor Ian McLean at Oxford has done this. They are absolutely absurd, completely impossible, and of course all the religions would want their bit. So who that 20% would be would become considerably more problematic. But I agree that's a minor issue that can be dealt with later. But my real objection is that this is a gross distraction. This is a way of looking under the table and over the table and around the side of the table where the elephant is about real reform. Even an elected House of Lords, if you were going to bring it in quite soon, will not breathe amazing new life and blood into British politics. The only thing that will do that will be PR.
Oh, for God's sake.
A chance for other parties to break through, a chance for old parties perhaps to break up.
Because you mean PR for the Commons?
For the Commons, I mean. And I do have to say, Jack, that you, together with John Prescott and Gordon Brown, have been the great roadblocks to reform all the way through. You've been the no-can-dos of this. And I think that Tony Blair would have made his deal with Ashdown had there not been such resolute objections from the likes of you. And we'd be in a very different place now politically. You could introduce AV now, and I know that you have said that you would be in favour of AV for the Commons, perhaps, but it would need a referendum. Well, it wouldn't need a referendum. You could do it just like that, because, again, it wouldn't be gerrymandering, because it wouldn't favour Labour. In fact, if anything, sophologists think it might slightly disfavour Labour, but it's still better than nothing. And, of course, you could have PR for the Commons in the same referendum at the next election as a referendum for an elected House of Lords. And I think that would be the best way forward. It would be fairest, most open. It puts it to the people. It does it now while you can. This is the last time that you can do that. I just think that you fail to grasp that we are in the middle of a really serious political crisis. We need something desperately to be done that really does give people a sense that power will be handed out in a better way, and that people can break down the present two-party system from which they're increasingly alienated.
Thank you very, very much. Very good. Don't worry, Jack Straw will have a chance to respond to that along with the other two panellists. So, Peter Facey, why don't you give us your response?
I don't actually disagree with Polly about the idea of having a referendum at next election in terms of, as an organisation which is committed to electoral reform and has been for the whole of its existence. But on Lords reform, I mean, you put a challenge to reformers. You said, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I suppose, as a leading reform organisation, campaigning organisation, after the 2003 vote, we very clearly said and launched a campaign called Elect the Lords, which premise was we want either a wholly elected or a predominantly elected. That remains the sort of baseline. The fact is, in principle, we are in favour of 100% elected. We will campaign for 100% elected. We will lobby for 100% elected. And we will make ourselves as awkward as possible to get 100% elected. But we are not going to cut our nose off and actually work with those people who actually want to derail election. You know, we want election. And if it means that I get an 80% election now and I come back and get 100% later, as a reformer who, Lords Reform is now being, 98 years old in terms of since the Parliament Acts, we have a little bit of patience. Not a lot, but a little bit. On some of the other issues, I'm very pleased that you have ruled out closed lists. I am worried about the word semi-open lists. As someone who, one of his first jobs around politics was actually lobbying around the European Elections Act and actually working with the Conservative front bench in terms of campaigning against closed lists, I know for a fact that semi-open lists in lots of cases can give you the perception of openness, whereas the reality can be that actually they are in effect closed. I accept that there are ways of making it more open than not, but I think that's a very important issue. I think there's some other kind of issues. I think one of the problems I have with the question of the bishops, I go to an Anglican church. My two children have just been baptised in the Anglican church, so it's not a kind of anti-Anglican position. But we talk about the Church of England being the established church. It's actually a bit more complicated than that, because this is the United Kingdom second chamber we're talking about, not the second chamber of England. We actually have two established churches in Britain, or at least one established church, one national church, the Church of Scotland. Yeah, sure. We have two parts of the United Kingdom which are actually not established at all in terms of Northern Ireland and Wales. But we're actually talking about keeping a system which actually says that effectively the other parts of the United Kingdom get Anglicanism through the back door by actually having them in the second chamber. Now, if we have taken 100 years to get to reform, I can't find a logical argument why the Church of England, as the established church of one part of the United Kingdom, has this predominant role. And therefore, for me, I think it is an issue of, and it's not me being anti-religion, it's not me being anti the Church of England.
No, sure.
On the question of what we do now, because actually for me that's kind of the most important, the more we can actually have votes in the House of Commons, the more we can actually force people to build a consensus. Because, one of the dangers when people talk about, particularly when politicians talk about consensus, is you get the impression that the consensus has to emerge. Consensus never emerge. They are built. Consensus is not the same as unanimity, because I don't think anybody here is saying that the DUP should be given a veto over whether or not we have Lords reform or not. And therefore we need to recognise that we need to have as many opportunities to actually make progress before the election. Now, I would love, like Polly, to actually guarantee that reform happened by the next election. I think, I'm a realist. It's not going to happen by the time of the next election. But what we can do is we can make it very difficult for anybody in any party who now says, actually, there isn't a blueprint. And I want to be in a position where people who are of a like mind to me can put any politician of any colour on the spot and say, OK, where do you stand on this? And if they say, we need consensus, it's a very important issue, but in principle, I want to say, well, there's this bill. Where do you stand on this bill? If you disagree with this bill, what bits do you disagree on? And why? And what are your intentions of doing it? Because the only way we are going to make progress is if we can actually create that momentum. And therefore, we need to use what is the next 9 months to build that momentum.
Thank you. Meg Ross.
It's very interesting to be sitting here, because the thing that Jonathan didn't mention is, aside from being at UCL at the Constitution Unit, I also worked for Robin Cook during the years when he was Leader of the House of Commons and trying to do this. So I remember very well what Jack's position was, of course. And I freely acknowledge the extent to which things have moved on, not just in his mind, but in terms of the Labour Party's position. But I am a bit concerned that there's a bit of an illusion of consensus going on here. There's less agreement than perhaps we like to think. I think we need to also think about, as Jack said at the beginning, we need to think very carefully about what we're trying to do and where we're starting from. And Jack puts it very well, the House of Lords has changed enormously since 1999, the removal of the hereditaries. There are some principles that still apply to the House of Lords, which are carried over from the old House. It remains unelected. It has a continuity of membership, people serving long terms, the longest terms possible, until they die. There's a degree of independence in there. The House has significant powers to delay government legislation. But we now have some new principles. And I agree with Jack that one of the most important, if not the most important principle, is we now have a no overall control chamber, where a government does not have a majority. It needs to build agreement with other parties and independents to get things through. And if it can't do that, it will lose votes. And it has lost a lot of votes. It's lost around 450 votes since the House was reformed. And there have been some very major policy concessions, as Jack says, to the House of Lords on issues which I think most people in this room would probably welcome. The House is also more professional than it used to be. It's more full-time than it used to be. It's more diverse than it used to be. So that's the starting point. What is it that we're trying to change? Well, clearly, we're talking about the principle of election. This is a very important principle, introducing democracy. And I think, along with it, what we're trying to do is introduce more legitimacy to the House of Lords and give it more confidence to challenge the government on dodgy bits of policy. It's already gained a lot of confidence, but election would give it more. So it is an important principle, but I think we also need to think about the other principles that currently apply. I think that when a bill is brought out, and we may have some discussion on this, given the rumblings in the audience, on issues like long terms and whether they should be renewable, I actually think those principles are very important, and I'm with Jack, actually, on both of those things. Based in part on what I know about second chambers in other countries. For some people, I think the consensus will break down on those issues. Mm. For some people, I think the consensus will break down on the powers of the House of Lords. I think particularly within the Labour Party, although there may be a lot of signing up to the principle of election now, I think there remain a lot of people who are quite concerned about a powerful elected House of Lords, sure, and who might want to see a bill with reduced powers of the House of Lords. Now, I think that's very problematic, because that's a principle that I would want to hold on to. And the most important principle of all is this one about no overall control. It's really valuable what we have now in the House of Lords, no overall control. And the idea that we might move to a House which was, yes, elected, but elected by first past the post, to me, is crazy. I think, I'd be interested to know whether other people agree, there are elected second chambers we can have which are better than the one we have now. There are also elected second chambers we can have which are worse than the one that we have now. And I think a first past the post elected House of Lords would be worse than what we have now. It's what the Tories want. Yeah. I also think that probably a PR elected House of Lords with significantly reduced powers would be worse than the one that we have now. So I think we need to be a bit explicit about what are our bottom lines. I think this is a question for everybody. I'm pleased to hear Jack saying that he's inclined to PR himself. Would he be opposed to a first-past-the-post elected second chamber? Would the others on the panel be? Would the audience be? Because particularly if we're going to have a Conservative government, we may face this question. Mm-hmm. Reformers may have to decide which is the more important principle, no overall control or election. I just wanted to say one other thing, which is, again, I'm afraid being rather supportive of Jack on this point about gradualism. There are also rumblings when he says, well, you know, maybe we move to 80 and 100 later, maybe we don't do the bishops, etc. I think looking back over British history, the reforms that have succeeded in terms of the House of Lords have been small, gradual steps. Yeah. Looking back at my time working for Robin Cook, I really didn't think this at the time, but in retrospect, I think he and I scuppered the chances for an elected second chamber for many years, because there was the Wakeham Commission, which was proposing a minority-elected House. It was supposed to be the government's position. Robin did everything he could to undermine that. And if we'd introduced that reform at the time, we might have had at least 20 or 30% elected, and we might now be talking about having more. So I think you need to embrace gradual reform when you can. And one final thing, there is a bill published now, the thing on getting rid of the remaining hereditaries and allowing people to retire from the chamber. And I'd just like to say that hasn't been mentioned yet, but I think on the same principle we should embrace that reform. Both of those things would further strengthen and legitimate the House that we have now, would remove elements that people think are problematic, indefensible. But there is one thing I think that should be added to that bill, which I think is probably a genuine government oversight, which is the quarantine clause, which Jack referred to in the elected bill, to ensure that people can't simply leave the House of Lords and go straight to the House of Commons. Some people might now call it the Mandelson Clause, but this idea has been around for a long time. It was in the Royal Commission's report. It's been in government white papers. It's not a personal issue about Peter Mandelson. It's a principle, and I think it would be good to see that in the current bill.
I only want very short ones on this because I want to bring people in, but just explain to us how you can keep the principle that you've explained it of no overall control and have election. How can you guarantee that an election will produce a no overall control chamber?
Well, you've got to have a genuinely proportional system in sufficiently large constituencies that you're electing enough people in each constituency to ensure that the outcome is proportional. And I'm not absolutely sure. I haven't gone back to the white paper and looked in terms of STV in the smaller constituencies. When you consider that you're electing a third of the House at a time, yes, and the House is going to be smaller, the number elected in each constituency actually isn't very great. And Peter, you're more of an expert on this than me. How many do you need to elect? But there's got to be quite a number elected in each area at one time.
If we're electing 3 to 5 people in a constituency, if you look at the two regions which elect 3 people for the European elections, Northern Ireland, which uses STV, and North East, which uses a list system, they both effectively elect one person from each of the three main parties in that area. Yeah. So, you know,
so you'd be sure to have no overall control for a single
party. If you have a proportional system elected over thirds, it would be very difficult, unless voting patterns in the United Kingdom massively changed, and we suddenly got parties but being elected on 50 and 60% of the vote, you would have no overall control or in second chamber.
But that, to me, actually is not enough, because I agree with Jack, it would be good to have an electoral system where independents could stand and win, and where Greens could stand and win, for
example. Which is why STV, there are arguments for STV, because it would be easier for independents to get elected.
All right. People are ganging to get in, so if there's something very specific you want to respond to, one of the three things, but keep it as short as you can, and then I want to take a whole lot of questions.
OK, very short. I'd just say to Polly, Polly, there is a category of people on the left who have been waiting to be disappointed and always always waiting to be disappointed about Labour governments, and tones have been written. And I'm sorry that I think that you're in that, because I don't think anybody can seriously look at what we've done in terms of the Constitution as a whole and say that we have not succeeded. We have. And I just say this because I know you're passionate in favour of proportional representation. You're entitled to be passionate in favour of proportional representation. But the idea, and I'm happy to join you in, as it were, oral combat in a referendum any time you want. The idea that our problems of democracy will be solved by proportional representations are for the birds. And just look at other countries who got proportional representation.
Okay, but don't get into the common PR thing because we are on the law.
Okay, well, that's what Polly.
Okay.
That's why I think it's a great diversion.
Don't wander off again.
Okay, yeah. Great diversion. And we can't suddenly just do this. I mean, I just remind Polly that on the People's Budget, the 1909 People's Budget, it took two general elections, both of which were not particularly conclusive, in 1910, and then the threat to George V before the Parliament Act went through. So it was slightly more complicated than she's proposing. And, a lot of what Peter says I agree with, and also with Meg. And Meg, as you know, I'm not proposing, and we're not proposing, to reduce the powers of the Lords. I mean, I've probably been responsible, God or ill, for more legislation in the last 12 and a half years than any other single minister. And I've had a lot of it changed by the Lords. I'm on the record as saying that although it can be irritating, almost always legislation has been improved by the parliamentary process. What I want to see now, and this would complement what the Lords are doing, is a strengthening of the role of the Commons in dealing with legislation. And it's not gained all that much coverage, but the committee that Tony Wright is chairing, which is about reducing the power of the whips, strengthening the power of the chamber over government business and over other business, in my view, is of profound importance to reinvigorating the Commons.
The very pointed question she put to you is, would you oppose first past the post, second chamber?
The answer to that is, I'm on a little journey on this. I've actively supported other systems, not first past the post, which have been introduced since 97. And there is, if you're asking me, is there any prospect of a Labour Party proposing first past the post before the first past the post for the election of the House of Lords? The answer to that is no. We put the three alternatives forward because those were the three which were represented the different views of the different parties. As to what I would do if faced with a proposal from, it would in this case be a Conservative government, for first past the post or to abandon the bill altogether, that would be a very difficult choice, is the answer, and it would be for the then Shadow Cabinet as well.
Thank you. Let's take people on. Lots of hands. Oh, wow. Okay, we're going to take about four or five in one go, bring it back to you, and then we'll keep going. We can go a little bit after 1 o'clock. You've been waiting very patiently. Why don't you kick off? If you can say your name and if there's an organisation or something, an affiliation that's relevant, perhaps mention it. Yeah.
Should I stand up?
Why don't you? Somebody. Oh, yes, and there are roving microphones just behind you. Keep the questions as short as you humanly can so we can get as many people in.
My name is Lord Cobbold. I'm a crossbench member of the House of Lords. I just think it's important. One central thing is we're not really talking anymore about reform of the House of Lords. We're talking about abolition of the House of Lords if you were looking for a 80% or 100% elected. The real reform of the House of Lords, in my view, took place in 1999 Act, and it has played a very valuable role. I quite agree that the anomaly of having 92 hereditary peers still there, of which I'm one of the beneficiaries, and I think it's quite right that should be phased out, as is now embodied in the new legislation which is before us. But I think that the House of Lords in the last 10 years has really been working amazingly well, and it is a unique reservoir of expertise and experience in almost all fields of life. And you'd never get that in an elected house. It's very unlikely that any or very few of the existing members of the House of Lords would wish to stand for election in the House of Commons in a new Senate. And so I put in a plea for a general rethink on this subject.
Thank you very much. Gentleman there, yeah. Let's give the microphone to you. Wait, there it is, yeah.
I'm Councillor John Bryant. I'm a member for Camden across the road, where we have a very successful partnership administration. You don't have to have strong one-party governments to actually do good things for your local community. In terms of the need to have, whether we have a 20% independent grouping or not in the House, in the second chamber, I would certainly be opposed to that. But I think you need to learn some lessons from local government. We've had this executive scrutiny split now for 7 years. And it's important to learn the lessons of the best scrutiny principles that we've established in local government. It seems to me that if you've got a government bill coming through, for example, on medical ethics, and we had a totally elected second chamber, you would want to co-opt for a short period people like Mary Warnock to, as an expert witness to help you in your deliberations over any bill of that kind. And it seems to me where we have in local government the option of co-opting independent members to our scrutiny committees in looking at pieces of work, the same power could obviously apply in the second chamber as well.
And would you have them just as a witness to give evidence or actually with a vote? On the bill, say.
That is a distinction that you may want to draw. I see no reason why speaking rights should always necessarily follow with a voting right. But clearly, you can use your expert witnesses, you can use your independent members the way you wish to in scrutinising individual pieces of work without them being there permanently.
Yeah.
And it seems to me a much more robust way of following through scrutiny patterns, including taking scrutiny evidence out into the country and having meetings elsewhere, out of the Palace of Westminster, or other issues that you ought to be dealing with in looking at reforming the way the Second Chamber works.
Thank you. Clear point well made. And woman here, if we can get the microphone to her, and I'm noting all the other hands, so don't panic.
Thank you. Abigail Locke from Scope. And I would like to come back to something that Jonathan touched on about selection and the power of party managers. For the past 3 years, Scope has been working with the candidates' offices of the three main parties, looking at their selection processes. And we found that there are many barriers to disabled people, and often this will be the selection at a local party level. And looking at the makeup of the House of Lords now, there are peers that just would not get through the selection process. So my question is, in whatever new system you have, would there be a minimum requirement, minimum numbers for underrepresented groups such as disabled people, such as women? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see if we can get sort of two more in. We'll take from this side, gentlemen here. Yeah, but wait until the microphone, here it comes. Short as you can. Yeah.
Thank you, sir. My basic problem is that the electorate, my name, first of all, Satish Desai Federal Union.
Yeah, okay, closer to my microphone.
Satish Desai Federal Union.
Okay, thank you.
My basic problem is that the electorate are not enthused, they are not well engaged, and they are not well informed as to what they'll be voting for. I mean, the very fact that the elected House of Lords will destroy its importance as a second chamber made of knowledgeable people. My apologies that those who read Guardians or Independent are probably well informed, but the election is won with what the sun tells you to do and Mr. Murdoch tells you to do. So I'm quite happy with the democracy as it is, but we need some chamber where there is no influence by the external agencies. And lastly, House of Lords is made of people who are known as cousins of Her Majesty the Queen. And I think it is incompatible with the system as we have to not to have them as something quite removed from what the will of the people is. And long live Her Majesty, I love her too much. But I'm prepared to put up with the unelected House of Lords, if that be it, for my remainder of my life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Still so many. Let's take one more. That's gentleman there, and then I will make sure we get the rest later. There we are. Yeah.
Hello. My name is Chris Bliss-Jones, and attending in a personal capacity. I just have a very simple question.
Yeah.
If you are proposing to phase in an elected House of Lords, so that, say, you start off with a third of the chamber being elected, how do you decide, on what basis do you decide, which third of the existing life peers get booted out?
Mm. Because that was so concise, we'll squeeze in one more. The woman here had her hand up before, if you can pass the microphone there to the lady there. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Anna McDermott. I'm representing Elwood and Atfield at the moment. Quick, simple question. What sort of long-term planning is there going to be, if any, for a quota system for female members?
Okay, thank you. Picking up what we heard before from Abigail Locke. So you've been furiously writing things down. I'll remind you of anything that you've forgotten.
Okay, right.
But the first one was Lord Crobbell's contribution about losing this unique reservoir of expertise.
Well, I mean, that's part of the argument in favour of a wholly appointed chamber, Lord Coburn. I don't think you would lose it completely, and other countries with elected second chambers are able to draw on, as it were, the good and the great, and they do so in other ways. And I also don't think that you'd have nobody of distinction. standing for election for a second. But, I mean, there are particular categories who wouldn't be sitting in the House of Lords, but they'd be able to contribute to public debate in different ways. And it also followed, by the way, the House of Lords is not an exclusive reservoir of talent. I mean, there are plenty of people outside the House of Lords who are perfectly capable of exercising great influence in our society, and where people take notice of them because of their expertise and the way they put their point.
You say there are other ways of drawing upon them,
yes.
Which takes us to our next question from the
Council. Well, it does. And I was going to say, I mean, I think we do need to learn a bit from the way local governments changed, and mainly changed for the better in recent years, and been quite flexible as well, because there are different models which have been applied. I mean, one of the things which I would say this, wouldn't I, because I was responsible for it, but one of the things I got through as leader of the House is the establishment of public bill committees as opposed to standing committees, which is, I mean, and with the Tony Wright changes could really alter the scrutiny of legislation in the Commons. And the first normally three sessions of a public bill committee, where it goes for a line-by-line examination, is where they select committee-style examination hearing, including the minister, which is, you know, put you on the spot, but of experts as well. There's no reason why these public bill committees shouldn't become quasi-select committees with the kind of expertise you're talking about to draw on. To Abigail and I think it was to Anna, about quotas. With women, there are specific proposals in here, and if you have a list system, you can actually prescribe that in any, and certainly across the country, you can ensure that it's 50-50 men and women. You just lay down that. I mean, say there are four places in one region to be elected. Well, you just say two are going to be women. So that's pretty straightforward. You can also get the parties, of course, to ensure a 50-50. With the disabled, it's more difficult to lay down because of difficulty. I mean, I don't say it's impossible, but it is more difficult. It's something we'd have to obviously talk about in detail and also get the parties to think about as well. Mr. Desai, you asked. You said that the second chamber. The advantage of the current second chamber is not influenced by external people with external agendas. Well, that's to a degree true, although the lobbyists wouldn't tell you otherwise. But I just say, since the 1832 Reform Bill has come up, that was exactly the argument the Duke of Wellington used against extending the franchise, because the argument was that the members of Parliament would then be susceptible to the will of the mob and the unwashed. To Lord Coburn, who said, if we moved to this, we'd abolish the House of Lords. Well, we'd certainly have to change the name. And the preamble to the 1911 Parliament Act talks about a second chamber with initial capitals. You call it second chamber, you call it a Senate.
But what's your own preference on that?
Well, my own preference, but I have to tell you, so I'm lifting the veil on government discussion, my own preference is to call it Senate, because I think calling it a second chamber sounds pretty odd. But I'm in a minority about that at the moment, so don't hold your breath for this becoming policy.
Does the Prime Minister prefer the term second chamber?
Well, he's not quite reached his elevated level. He's got other things on his mind. Chris Jones asks about how do you decide who goes?
Yeah.
There's a lot of discussion in here. About it, and you have to first of all decide how many go and how quickly. Now, there are some, and this will be one of the arguments, who will say, well, people there should stay until they depart this mortal coil. But if you have that, you end up with a very large chamber for a long time, which I think would mock the reform. So I think you have to start reducing the numbers with each elected tranche.
You offer a redundancy package.
Query just like how you do it. I mean, bluntly, there are, you know, how you do it is you could do it by lot. The fairer way would be to do it by election from within each group. And here we have got the example of how the hereditaries operated, that the hereditaries were told, well, you can't have however many hundreds they had before, 600 or 700, but you can have 90. So they've formed themselves into electoral colleges. I may say for the Labour Party, since we only have four hereditaries, the electoral college has fewer voters than the voters in Old Sarum in pre-1832 Reform Act, old rotten borough. But that's one of the many reasons why we're getting rid of that.
So in other words, the Labour Life peers would say who carries on the Conservative Life.
But they'd have a balance.
Crossbenchers, yeah.
No, that's, okay. I think, the most sensible way.
OK. Let's try and take another round, and then there's going to be a final question from me, and then we'll close it up. So we'll see if we can get more or less everybody in. Because where's the first microphone? Why don't you take these two? One man is waving agitatedly, so we perhaps should relieve the pressure by giving the microphone to him first. OK, you've gone for it first, but you'll be next. You don't need to wave, you're going to be next. Yeah.
My name is John Preston, Federal Union.
We've had two from the Federal Union.
Well, it's disproportionate representation. We're proportionately represented.
OK, yeah. As quick as you can, yeah.
I think Jack would find a lot of the things that he's been changing his mind out a lot easier if it was quite clear what this change is for. Because the original purpose of an elected chamber was to get rid of the House of Lords, and everything thereafter would be much more straightforward. Given that the change would be to bring in minorities and to have the backup of democracy, how much has been looked at the constitution of other countries with similar experience, so that rather than faffing about wondering what on earth would happen, we can learn from the experience of other countries and the plug for the Federal Union. I think federal countries give you some very good examples to look at. So.
All right, pass the microphone to the man next to you. I'm hoping he's not from the Federal
so
Union.
So, Aston's my name. I was going to say a maverick. Unassigned. My question supports the previous questioner. My question is, what improvements in performance would a reformed second chamber bring?
Thank you. No, admirably concise. There's a lady here. If we can bring the microphone to her. We're going to try and get everybody in. So, you know, just...
Sally Muggeridge, Industry and Parliament Trust, and Jack knows us very well. I just want to speak up for industry, and I hope we're not rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because what business wants is better informed legislation. Legislation that understands the needs of business and the economy. And I haven't seen a lot of evidence since I've been running the Industry and Parliament Trust that we're attracting those with business knowledge, apart from, as Lord Cobble says, the House of Lords, those that are from industry, that really will make a difference in terms of our economic success. And that's the problem.
Good. That's concise and helpful. Why don't you pass it here? Yeah. How many more have we got? About three or four. OK. Any new hands I think I'm not going to take? Yeah.
Jonathan Frayer, freelance journalist and blogger. Secretary of State, you probably noticed a certain scepticism in parts of the audience about the degree of the government's commitment to moving towards an elected House of Lords, not to mention the urgency. Given the fact that you say that you would be in favour of either an open or semi-open list for regional elections to the House of Lords, wouldn't one very quick and easy way of showing good faith be to bring in open or semi-open lists for the European elections?
OK, thank you. OK, this is going to be the last group. If you've got the microphone there, if you take it to the lady at the end there, who's got a hand up? No, at the end, further up. Follow my hand, you'll see. Can you see my hand? There. There we are, yeah. Good.
Mary Southcott, Labour Campaign for Electoral Reform. I hope from what Jack said that he'll be supporting Vote for Change in the referendum so we can have a quick, swift discussion with him about electoral reform at the general election. But wearing my other hat, I'm a vice chair of the Campaign for English Regions, and the House of Lords reform looked, I think we thought, that it might be an answer to the English dilemma, which has become more of a dilemma since we don't have elected regional assemblies in England, and English devolution is going to be a question, I think, which will come up. And I wonder how Jack sees a second chamber as answering some of that dilemma.
Thank you. Unfortunately, more hands keep going up each time. We can't do everybody in the room, so I'm going to have to take the final three. You've been waiting a long time, the hand waving there in the middle. And you have too, actually, so you're going to be next.
Yes, John Strafford. Mr. Straw, you said that you wanted a second chamber to complement the House of Commons and not a rival, and yet you don't seem to have any problem with the European Union passing legislation, which is a rival to the House of Commons. Okay. You have no problem with the Scottish Parliament passing legislation, and you set the rules by which the Scottish Parliament operates. So you could easily set the rules by which the House of Lords or Second Chamber should operate. And the truth of the matter is that the House of Commons is running scared, and you're scared that if we had a wholly elected House of Lords, elected by a fair method of proportional representation for a fixed term, it would be very successful. And the people might turn around and say, hey, why isn't the House of Commons like this? And why do we have a House of Commons? Why do we have a House of Commons? And I have to say, during the course of your talk, I got the impression that you thought it was the envy of the world, an example of democracy, first past the post, wonderful. The people out there think you're a bunch of charlatans elected under a rotten electoral system with your snouts in the trough all the time. And the quicker you get changed, the better.
All right, thank you. No, let's wind it up there. You're quit while you're ahead. Let's go to the gentleman here, and then you're going to be the last speaker. Thank you.
Sam Townend, Labour prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol North West, a marginal Labour seat.
Good luck with
Jack,
that.
Thank you. Yeah. Jack, this is really with a view to the possibility, at least, that I'm not successful in getting elected. How do we ensure, how do you use this next 6-9 months to ensure that, and I think, for example, the Conservatives' view that they expressed in their manifesto of the substantially elected second chamber, or whatever the phrase was, is clearly not supported by them now. And if they do get in, then absolutely nothing will happen unless we put in the grounds now by which they can't avoid it. How do we get that in? How do we use the next 6 to 9 months to ensure that the legacy of this part of our constitutional reform is firmly there?
Okay. Thank you. Distinguished final question.
Tom McNally, I'm the leader of the Liberal Democrats in the House of Lords. I do have a very good hour-long speech on House of Lords reform, which includes a very good purple passage denouncing Jack Straw's earlier stand on the issue. But we'll leave. No, my question is a very precise one. The big block to reform of the House of Lords is that when the Lords voted on the issue, its vote was almost a mirror of the House of Commons. Yeah. And I was the only leader of any party that had the majority of their members supporting reform of the Lords. Are we going to offer the House of Lords a veto on House of Lords reform? Or would Jack consider using the Parliament Act if the Lords acted in that way?
Thank you very, very much for all of those questions. That's the last round. So, you know, you've noted them. The first three all address this issue of the quality of legislation and performance. What guarantees do you have that this would improve the quality? And there was this particular angle about legislation for business and industry. Perhaps those three could come together.
Okay. Well, have we looked at examples of other countries? Yes, and Meg actually has done a great deal of work about that. And a lot of that is summarised in the white papers and previous documents. Of course, you don't start trying to reinvent the wheel. What is it for, our Sally, and also the preceding questioner? It's principally, it's about legitimacy. That's in the room, as it were, the argument about, for those of you who support proportional representation, about making a system more legitimate. And to repeat what I said earlier, it is actually very, very difficult in a 21st century democracy to justify having this amount of power, and it is a lot of power, in a second chamber where people are wholly unelected. And we've talked a lot about the very exceptional people who are in the House of Lords, but it's also fair to say that quite a number of, as Tommy's nodding his head, there are also others there, quite a lot of them.
On all benches.
I'll leave the sentence incomplete. but I also think you would get a continuing improvement in the actual performance of the Lords, of the new second chamber, in terms of holding government to account and dealing with legislation. And one of the things I've had to say to my colleagues in the Commons in getting them to come on the same journey as I'm on is that it's not a zero-sum game between the Commons and the Lords. There is not a fixed quantum of scrutiny which has to be shared between us. That my own very powerful view, and it's made more powerful by 12 years as a minister rather than less, is that the more scrutiny there is by both chambers, the better government is with a small g. Because it keeps ministers on their toes. All right? And it also ensures that what you're legislating on, roughly speaking, is more likely to gain the consent of the people. And the big balls-ups that have been made by this government and by others, and I'm not going to list them, have principally been where issues have not been thought through properly and there's been insufficient scrutiny. So, on the Jonathan Froude asked, how about starting with open or semi-open lists for the European elections? Well, I'm not personally against that, and if you want to bet, I think that there may well be. Now we've had the third election under the closed list system, a wish to have a fresh look at how you operate the list system. Mary asked about the campaign for English regions, and would we see a second chamber as answering, or to some extent answering this issue about English devolution? Yes, I mean, and I think that's one of the advantages of a regional list system. I mean, the problem, Mary, is, I mean, where I'm fully with you, was on setting up strong, powerful regional assemblies in England. But there was a referendum in the North East, remember, which I thought was going to be won hands down, which was lost hands down, and that's rather thwarted that. Mr. Sleaford, well, just to make the point about the European Union and the Scottish Parliament, Mr. Sleaford, both of these, we joined the European Union as a result of a decision by the House of Commons in 1971, subsequently endorsed in 1975 by a referendum. And to those people who don't like the European Union, what I say is go and campaign to get a party and 326 MPs either to call for a referendum to withdraw from the European Union or to commit ourselves to it. And then, you know, that decision can be made by the sovereign parliament. Just say, you know, and ditto if you want to...
Yeah, his point, I think, was that the Commons does have challenges to its primacy from many sources. Well, so why? What's the problem?
Oh,
with
I see. Well,
it wasn't a withdrawal.
I don't accept that it's a challenge to the primacy. I'm sorry, and I'm not in the Bill Cash view of if you know who Bill Cash is. The Commons is the sovereign parliament of the United Kingdom, and if we wanted to tomorrow, we could pass legislation denouncing our membership of the European Union, and we could come out of the European Union, and there's nothing anybody could do to stop us. I don't have to be in favour of that, but there are people in favour of it. Ditto, if we wanted to wind up the Scottish Parliament, we could do so. I'm not in favour of that either, but it's nothing to stop us doing it. You also said, it was talked about the need for, you said the people out there think we're a bunch of charlatans elected under a rotten electoral system. The difficulty is, to make this point, is if you go to other countries with proportional representation systems, they will also tell you that their members of Parliament are rotten, bunch of charlatans, elected under a very bad electoral system. Ask people in Israel, ask people in the Czech Republic, in all those countries which have been using proportional representation. Look at the academic work. Look at the academic work in Norway, where they had this major inquiry into the inadequate state of their democracy and concluded that proportional representation was part of the problem, not the solution. People can have an argument in favour or against proportional representation, but please do not let us have it elevated into some kind of moral principle, because it isn't, and it produces different consequences, and nor imply that those of us who support first-past-the-post, which is used in India, it's used in the United States, used in many other administrations, those who support, or AV as in Australia, those of us who might support the single-member system, so somehow have a less claim on the sort of morality of the body politic. Sam asks about how do we use the next 6 to 9 months. Mm. Well, Sam, I shall come and campaign for you. As I said right at the beginning, I don't happen to believe, and I don't, the election is lost. I certainly don't. Not for a second, because I happen to believe that what we have done on constitutional issues, right? First of all, the most radical reforming government on constitution, certainly since the war, dramatic changes we've introduced, right? Which no one can gainsay, and the Tories would have done none of them. They did do none of them. What we've done on equality, for example, equality for women, equality for people who are black and Asian, for those who are have a different sexual preference. Dramatic changes. The Tories never did any of those. They've not passed a single piece of legislation in favour of racial equality, not one. They did, of course, pass a piece of legislation about gender equality. It was called Section 28. That was the one piece they introduced. So this is a record of which I'm proud. And on inequality of incomes, what we have done is greatly to improve the living standards of people at the bottom. We haven't done enough, as Polly's absolutely rightly pointing out, based on the excellent evidence of Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. We haven't done nearly enough in terms of income, overall income inequalities, and that's got to be the agenda for the next government. But I just tell you this, and it's of profound importance, and the evidence in the spirit level, which is the latest Wilkinson Pickett book, is really important. Just tell you this, it's only going to be a Labour government that can deliver that compression of inequalities with all the benefits that will go for our society if we get there. Okay. So those are powerful arguments in favour of a Labour government, and I shall be making them. Now,
last question from Tom McNally about will you give a veto to the House of Lords on reform?
No. And so would it follow that if necessary you'd have to use the Parliament Act? Yes. I don't think the House of Lords would be foolish enough. But if you had to, you'd have to. I think that's your view too, Tom, isn't it?
Yes, but don't underestimate its foolishness.
Thank you.
Well, you say that from greater expertise than me.
I wouldn't be doing my journalistic duty if I let you go without asking you about an unrelated other topic. Since you are the Secretary of State for Justice, if you had been in the shoes of your Scottish counterparts, as we've been talking about Scottish Union, what decision would you have taken on the release on compassionate grounds of the Lockerbie prison?
What I would have done is to look at all the evidence before me and come to a view on that evidence, as I have done, six and a half years of being responsible for the prison system in England and Wales. What I can't offer you is a view about that decision because I've not seen the evidence and I simply haven't seen it. And it's as the Prime Minister made clear yesterday, and I'm not going to because I know from long experience that you have to look at the evidence. And the Prime Minister said yesterday, this is a decision for the Scottish Executive.
Do you think, though, in gathering that evidence, the Scottish Justice Secretary made the right move in going to visit the prisoner in jail? Would you have done that if you'd been in his...
Well, that was his decision. If you're asking me whether I ever visited a prisoner in jail who's applied for compassionate release, the answer to that is no. What I had said, and this has been on the public record, what I said in answer to questions from the Joint Committee on Human Rights, which was raising issues, it's actually about the prisoner transfer agreement, which in the end wasn't used, but raising issues about, since this was a PTA where the consent of the prisoner was not directly required, what rights would the prisoner have? Well, I said in a letter to Alex Salmond, that the prisoner would have a right to make written representations, which for sure is true, but it's for Scots to decide their own processes, and their legal system has been different forever. I mean, it's not just been different since 1999, it's been different. Mm. It was part of the Act of Settlement, the Act of Union in 1707. I've not gone on visits to individual prisoners.
And you were about to say, would you have done it? And what would be the answer?
I'm saying you would not
have gone to see him.
I can't say I would not have gone, because I'm just saying I haven't seen all the circumstances. Have I ever gone to see a prisoner in those... A prisoner who's applied for compassionate release? No. I've relied on written representations. But there we are.
Since we're talking about the devolution settlement, is it quite convenient for the UK government that this decision was taken by the Scottish government and the SNP administration?
I don't think it's an issue of convenience or otherwise, Jonathan. If it hadn't been taken by the Scottish Executive, it would have fallen to the Scottish Secretary of State. It's not an issue of convenience. It has always been the case that Scotland's had a separate jurisdiction. I may say for the lawyers present, those of us who are lawyers know that it's a very separate jurisdiction. And this was just a natural consequence of that separate jurisdiction.
And you don't have an opinion whether it was right or wrong?
I can't have an opinion on whether it was right or wrong. I've not seen the evidence. And I don't think even The Guardian would be asking me to shoot from the hip on that issue without seeing the detailed evidence. And also, I'm not in that position. And I just say that my last point here is that there is... Even if you have seen the evidence, there is a world of difference between having to come to a decision, which is a binary choice, and it's, do you let these individuals out or don't you? Making observations from the sidelines.
And when you say evidence, you mean about how ill he was?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the sort of evidence I had to consider, for example, in respect of Mr. Biggs.
Well, that was off the topic, but thank you very much for addressing that. And a larger thank you for engaging really actively with our main theme today on House of Lords. I'm sure everybody will want to join our panellists.